When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
However, standing by right now is the one and the only, Sean Mooney.
Who?
Mooney, everybody's got a price for the $1 million man.
After you threw him off through the announce table, Taker climbs back down, he gets in the ring, and he goes, see if he's breathing.
Right before I called 911, I thought she'd fallen asleep. Kind of shook her a little bit to wake her up, and she did not respond.
And I'll go to my grave, testifying or whatever, swearing that Davey was not on drugs. If he was on drugs, the way Brett says, how great does that make Davey?
Are you laughing, Sean?
I get off the track here all the time.
Did you just laugh, Sean?
If they would do a movie about your life, who would you want to play your part?
Well, George Clooney, of course. Who else could it be?
Attention, Sean Mooney, you scum, you slime, you maggot. If there's no further questions, you're dismissed. Carry on, maggot.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to Prime Time with Sean Mooney. It has been some week coming off the Dave Milliken episode, one of my all-time favorites, I have to tell you. And I've said this about other episodes, but this was really a great one. I really enjoyed it. You know, he's one of the greatest belt craftsmen alive, he along with Reggie Parks. And it was a great conversation because a lot of that stuff that we talked about, I had no idea. I never knew there were so many incredibly interesting aspects to making a title belt, the history, all the stories behind crafting one, the people who have worn them, the collectors, you know, the stories, the belts being lost and found, and the people and organizations that have commissioned them. I mean, just fascinating stuff. So I loved that episode. And Dave Milliken, thank you. We got another great conversation coming your way this week. Once again, another guest you might not expect to ever hear from, except right here on Primetime with Sean Mooney. What do you say? Let's get to it. Joining us this week is a member of the very first broadcast team for Monday Night Raw. Do you remember who that team was? Well, I'll tell you. Vince McMahon, the Macho Man Randy Savage, and our guest this week, Rob Bartlett. Ding, ding, ding. Folks, my guest this week shares a time in WWF/WWE history with me. That's right. We both appeared on the first episode ever of Monday Night Raw. And I was out on the streets of New York City freezing my ass off. He was inside the Manhattan Center, part of the original Raw announce team with Vince McMahon and the Macho Man Randy Savage. But that is just one of his many claims to fame, as we will discuss. Welcome, comedian, writer, actor, Don Imus sidekick, Rob Bartlett. Rob, how are you?
I'm good, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm actually in a closet right now. I'm in the middle of moves.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And I came over here to the house because it's the only place that has internet. I was like, I am in a closet right now. I'm surrounded by blankets, and that's the best I can do today. So,
the foreclosure came through, I guess?
Yep, they are throwing my ass out. It's over.
You know, you said you were cold, freezing your ass off on the street. I was getting a much chillier reception inside, so I don't know who is colder, you or the crowd.
Yeah, which one's worse, right? Yeah, you know what? Well, we will get into all that.
Okay.
But, you know, first, though, before we talk about the WWF and how that all happened, folks, if you have not had an opportunity to experience the comedy of Rob Bartlett, a part of your life is missing because he has done so much along the way. Of course, you're most well-known for your appearances, your many, many appearances with Don Imus and his programs. And also, though, you know, not just a comedian. I know you started in stand-up, but a writer and some great acting roles and Broadway. I mean, we're not talking off-Broadway. I mean, like big-time Broadway. And where did it all begin? I mean, you grew up in a great place for it to happen. And it just seems like if you don't grow up entertaining, and I mean being in that area of the country, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, I think Long Island, you're going to have to wind up entertaining in one form or another because it's just a survival technique.
Yeah.
I, you know, was the quintessential class clown. I was the really annoying person that everybody hated. Yeah. Had to get the last word in, had to, you know, be the center of attention. And I mean, I used to come up with spontaneous musicals that I would sing a cappella in the street using the various people who lived in the neighborhood as characters, to the amusement of my friends. And that's kind of where it started. And then, you know, became a drama geek in high school, took a little theater in college, and I took a leave of absence in college to pursue stand-up because comedy was, you know, always been my thing.
Yeah.
And wound up doing well enough to figure I didn't need to go back to school. So, and I've been a professional comedian ever since.
Did you grow up in a family of entertainers? Was your family funny? Or, you know, because a lot of the cases you talk to comedians and they were just surrounded by it.
My father was funny. My father was very funny. My father actually looked a lot like Jackie Gleason, and he could do not a great impression of Jackie, but he did a great impression of Frank Fontaine, you know, with the I don't know if you remember that show.
Yeah.
I'm dating myself. Anyway, yeah, he was a funny guy. I got a lot of my sense of humor from him. And, you know, there was nothing better than making him laugh because then it was like praise from Caesar, you know.
Yeah,
And like every comedian will tell you, they were on a constant search for approval. So if it wasn't my father, it was Imus, and now it's you. So
yeah, there you go. when did you discover the voices that you could imitate people?
I had a kind of an ear for it, you know, and I could kind of do exaggerated impressions of the people from the neighborhood and eventually turn that to the school, you know, to teachers. I would, get them, you know, pretty much nail them and try and use that against them in any way, shape, or form I could, you know. So that was kind of the thing, you know, and then would learn after listening to a voice that I could kind of, you know, approximate. There were some people I could nail. Some people I only do what they call impressions of, which is just kind of like everybody's Christopher Walken. Everybody can do a Christopher Walken, but it's an impression. Right. It's an impression. It's not impersonation, which is, you know, what people like Jay Moore does, the perfect impersonation of Christopher Walken, because he's such an easy guy to, you know, kiddo, imitate. It's easy. It's really easy, you know.
That's awesome. But who was your first one that you really nailed? I mean, that ever, you know, there was a celebrity or somebody that you imitated.
It was Mr. Sweeney, who lived next door. That was the first one I nailed. And then after that, I think it was the Beatles. I kind of had, you know, the Liverpool accent down. I do John was kind of up a cadence there, up in the register. And then Paul, of course, was much softer and quieter and much, much higher. And then George was more like very quiet and back, and he liked to sing about things. And Ringo, I got a hole in my pocket. You know, so those were the first ones, I guess. And then it kind of progressed from there.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, I mean, I love comedy too, and you and I could go on for hours. I think that you are, in some ways, must be a historian as well as with comedians. And you know, I was crazy about Jerry Lewis when I was a kid. I mean, I watched all the movies.
Oh, everybody was.
Yeah, but were there comedians that you idolized back then? Guys that you really said, you know, God, I want to be funny like him.
Jonathan Winters was really the first one.
Really? Yeah.
Jonathan Winters kind of inspired the kind of comedy I do, which is mostly character driven and kind of crazy and not really monologue stuff. But, you know, I used to watch him whenever he was on any of the talk shows. And, you know, Carson was famous for like giving him a stick. And Winters would literally do 20 minutes just using the stick as various props. And you'd hurt. You'd laugh so hard. I mean, that was a very, very amazing, genius comedian. And then as I got older, what's his name too? I liked a lot. The Pink Panther. What the hell is
Pink Panther?
Nobody can remember names anymore. Yeah. Peter Sellers. I was a big fan of. He did a movie called The Party where he played a Hindu movie extra. And it was just a stupid movie, but boy, was he funny in that. And, you know, of course, Abbott and Costello, and you know, Little Rascals, and Three Stooges, and Marx Brothers, you know, even Marlon Hardy, you know, that kind of stuff. And you learned old school. And then it was like a lot of comedic actors, like Walter Matthau, I really liked. And, you know, the guy who really inspired me to do stand-up is Pat Cooper. I forget what he was. He was on something, like on a Sunday night. Might have been Sutherland. And my father was laughing hysterically at this routine. It was an Italian wedding routine that he did. And my father went out and bought the album, and I listened to it intently. And then I actually did it in word for word. Yeah. I did that bit in my kindergarten Christmas party. So that was my first. I was trying to impress Ida Green, of course, and you try to impress a woman.
Did it work? No.
I've never once gotten any from doing stand-up, Sean.
Jeez.
All this effort for nothing. Yeah, that was the first time I actually ever did stand-up. So Pat was a big influence. And then later, when I knew, you know, exactly what it took to be funny and what it took to be a comedian.
And of course, it is.
Yeah. And it was like people like George Carlin and Pryor and, you know, that you really, like, were in awe of, you know.
And Lenny Bruce. I mean, is that edgier comedy?
Yeah, and just, you know, the looking at things from, like, the other side, you know, kind of a turning something on its side and looking at it. I mean, Carlin was the best at that, and Pryor was the best at just taking everyday things that everyone kind of shared and knew. You didn't have to be black, you didn't have to be white, whatever it was this universal knowledge. What he was talking about was just about being a human, and man, with that physicality he had and the voices, and, I mean, there was nobody like him. I saw him at City Center when he was doing the tour for the first movie, the Richard Pryor live movie, whatever it was. And Patti LaBelle opened for him. Mm-hmm. And Patti LaBelle's mother had died like the night before. So she gave the most emotional show. I mean, her performance was like over the top. It was just amazing how great she was. I mean, the place was just lit up and people were screaming and crying and I thought to myself, oh, my God, he's going to have to set his dick on fire to follow this.
Yeah.
And, of course, not knowing later on it would actually happen. But, he walked out without being announced. They didn't even turn the house lights down after intermission. And I forget what he said to open the show, but the audience went crazy. And he kept at that level, that level of laughs through the entire 90-minute set. I was in awe. I mean, it was just nobody like him.
Yeah. I mean, he could riff on anything. The whole bit he does on visiting Africa and
you know, he was one of the first to really. I mean, he and Colin, they actually kind of said something with their comedy. You know, in the tradition of Lenny Bruce, obviously, like make social commentary. You know, I mean, pretty amazing.
Yeah, and when you talk about it, like that's when comedy started to change, and because you know I was of that age when you had your. Like you said, Jonathan Winters and you know, George Burns and Shecky Green and these Borscht Belt guys who had made the transition to television and even, you know, somebody like I was thinking before we went on, I said, you know, like Freddie Roman.
Oh, God.
Who was like just dropped dead. I remember I was at a killer. And I worked for Major League Baseball Productions and I went to the baseball writers dinner and he was the comedian. I'd never heard of him before. And I remember the joke that he told, and you couldn't do it today, but when he talks about Pia Zadora acting, and he said, "I, you know, she was so bad, and it was, she was an Anne Frank." And when the Nazis came to the house, you know, she was so bad, the entire audience stood up at once and yelled, "She's in the attic!" And I remember just crying. It was just the funniest. And I went, and they had a WrestleMania at Atlantic City, and he was playing a room there, and I had a break between what we were doing, and I went and saw Freddie and just cried my eyes out. I was
a master, I've worked with him a number of times, and I'm always, you know.
And nobody's heard of him, in, I mean, on a broad, giant scale, you know what I mean?
No, but, I mean, but the level of success he has, he's the king, you know what I mean? And he's well-respected by everybody in the comic community, you know.
But my point of it is back then it was just funny. They didn't send a political message or and then you had people like Carlin, but that give a message, but we're funny. And so today it's really different. You can't say anything because a lot of your comedy is, you know, you could call a lot of insult comedy, you know, like Rickles, along the line with Rickles. You can't do that.
No, you can't. And so, you know, anything that has anything to do with sexism or, I mean, it's a different world, and I understand where it comes from, but it also kind of is really bad if you're going to censor comedians. You know, I mean, I've never been the kind of comic who wants to say something to me. I don't think anybody could care anything about what I have to say or what I think about anything. I just want to, you know, squirt the seltzer in my pants and make you laugh. You know, that's all I want to do. But there are comics out there who are kind of restrained from being able to make their points in a way that it would make sense. I just saw a thing on Netflix, Larry Charles, the guy who used to do the Seinfeld show. Yeah. He went around the world and he went to Iraq to see what Iraqi comedians were like. And it was pretty amazing to see what chances they took, and you can't do anything like that now here, so I don't know, you know.
Yeah, well,
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Oh, that, if, when they say I died, I mean, you really, something there would be.
I bombed.
Might. I mean, you've got to be careful in other countries. Yeah. No, but, you know, and I'd love to go through this, you know, how your career and how you ended up. We are going to get there, but we're going to have to kind of fast forward a little bit. But you were a comedian. You were coming up at a perfect time because I lived in Manhattan in the 80s. And that was when, you know, the rage of comedy clubs.
Yep.
I mean, everybody had a comedy club. If you had a restaurant, you had a basement, then, you know, two nights a week you were doing comedy. You had comedy in there. And for you, was that like a great opportunity for you?
Oh, it was. I couldn't have started any other time. I mean, we were very lucky. There were more rooms than there were comedians, and you could literally work every night of the week and not repeat a club for months. You know, any town that was within an hour distance of an airport had a comedy club or two or three. So, and that's when all the showcase clubs like Catch a Rising Star and the Comic Strip and the Improv, that's when they were reign supreme. And, you know, you'd wait outside in the cold in the morning to get a number to go on the open mic night. And then, you know, if you passed, they invited you back to do 3 o'clock in the morning sets until you worked your way up the ladder. And it was a great time. You know, it's my favorite time because it was, you're doing it just for the fun of it. You know, whenever you start to make money off something, it kind of loses a little something. So, but that was when it was just pure, you know, and we could make our own rules. I mean, on Long Island, we were lucky because we controlled everything. I think there wound up being eventually 4 or 5 clubs on Long Island when all was said and done before the boom exploded and it all went in the toilet. But we just, you know, we had the East Side Comedy Club, we had the Brokerage, we had governors. We had all these places, Chuckles. Yeah. And, you know, they were all home bases, and it was a great camaraderie.
Oh, and it was amazing then. You know, I lived 78th in York, so I was, you know, two blocks from Catch a Rising Star.
Right.
And you could go in there, and they would have, you know, the open mic nights.
Yep.
But what was awesome about it is those nights, I can't even remember, it was like a Monday night or something like that. Mm-hmm. You buy a beer, or, you know, basically, or two beers. But if you hung around late, people would come in to try material. And I saw Robin Williams there one night, Rodney, who lived, you know, just a couple blocks away. He had that in that high rise building that he bought two apartments or something. But anyway, he would just drop in, and he would have. I remember he had a napkin, and he'd sit there, and he wouldn't even look up. He just basically he'd hop in, he'd have like written on a piece of paper a napkin, and you know he'd do his, hey, you know, my wife and I like to have. Like that phone sex. She calls me whenever she's having sex. Okay, you like that one. You know, people laugh. You know, she was so ugly, you know. Yeah, so fat. She was in the middle of the street. So I hit her. She said, why'd you hit me? I said, I didn't have enough gas to go around, you know. Oh, you like that. it was magical. You had to wait, and some nights nothing happened. But every few weeks or so, one big guy would drop in, and it was an incredible time.
Oh, yeah. It was a great time.
So, getting through this, I mean, you're doing stand-up. How did the connection to IMUS happen? Because that really was a big springboard for your career.
So, what happened, and the way I got in with IMUS was, I used to open for Soupy Sales, and he had a show on NBC, and I'd come on with him whenever I wanted to promote, like, a benefit I was doing or something.
Yeah.
And I was kind of doing a benefit at this club in Bayside called Jimmy's Comedy Alley. It was an old bowling alley. It was for Tomorrow's Children, or it was, you know, maybe it was Make-A-Wish Foundation. That's what it was. And for whatever reason, I don't think Soupy was on that week. So I'm doing a gig one night with a guy by the name of Mark Sheff, who was IMUS's producer before Bernard.
Right.
And Mark says to me, well, why don't you come down and do IMUS show, you know, on Friday? We do comedians on Fridays. So I said, yeah, that'd be great. You know, so I'd known IMUS from, you know, he was on like clock radio when I was a kid in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd wake up to him, you know, he'd play Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. And, you know, he'd come in after the record saying, well, you're not going to let your son go down on me. How about your daughter? And they would go, they would go to like 40 minutes of Morgan music, you know, at that point. So I was thrilled I could actually, you know, meet him. And so I went in and did my Tom Carvel bit, which was my signature bit at the time. It was this three-character little mini play that I had with Tom Carvel and a guy who owned one of the stores and the guy's wife who was from Italy and didn't speak any English. Mm-hmm. And that was my signature bit. That was my big closer. So I did that for IMUS, and he went nuts. Just went nuts. And so I said, oh, anytime you want to come back. So... I took him at his word. I showed up whenever I could. I'd get my butt out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd take the train into the city, and I'd, you know, pop in. Oh, Rob Wells. I'd come in, and I'd, you know, start doing some riffs and whatnot live with him. And then he said, well, why don't you try doing bits? Why don't you come in after the show and do, like, recorded bits? I said, all right. So he said, that way we can pay it. We can start paying it. So that's fine. I like that idea.
So I
started going in after the show was over to do recorded pieces, and I got like two or three on a day, and then if they played them on the Best of IMUS on the weekends, you got like another, you know, $12 or whatever it was that they paid. And then all of a sudden, you know, he goes to rehab in the summer, that summer, and he you know, that Charles McCord, his newsman, takes over the show. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, a big gap. You know, they're kind of losing a little something. And so the program director, by the name of Jim Collins, he called. He said, why don't you start coming in with us? I said, great. So I started coming in with them and did it enough. And I guess IMUS got some air checks and liked what he heard. You know, thought he could trust me to be part of the show. So when he came back, they offered me a full-time gig, which kind of coincided with the sale of NBC. And that's when we moved over to WFAN, and I was there for 31 years.
Yeah, God, just amazing. But, you know, obviously you're allowed to do other things. And so how did the, And we'll get to what everybody's been wanting to hear about is your connection to Vince McMahon. Do you do a good? I have to imagine you do a good Vince McMahon. I seem to recall. That's not a tough one though, is it?
No. But it says, I like the fact that whenever he would do the play-by-play, you couldn't really understand what he was saying. It was just such frenetic.
So how did he discover you? How did Vince discover you?
Well, I was doing through IMS, I got connected with the Connecticut Special Olympics, and they would do fundraisers all the time, and I would do the auctions. Mm-hmm. And so I got asked to do one up. I think it probably was, what's the town where?
In Stamford somewhere, right?
In Stamford, yes. I was doing a thing in Stamford, and Vince was there, because Vince was a big supporter of Special Olympics, I think. Mm-hmm. One of the things I got to say about him is that whole organization has been really amazing when it comes to charitable work. I mean, they're always sending guys into hospitals and whatnot, and it's all about the kids. And so he was there, and he's sitting at a table up front, and he was wearing a peach velour three-piece suit.
You couldn't
peach
resist.
No.
Instant material.
I did 20 minutes. on the suit. I mean, it was lines.
Do you remember
like,
any of it?
Oh, one of them was like, you know, it's such a great looking suit. I wonder what it would look like if a heterosexual was wearing it.
Oh, man.
You know, like stuff like that. I really, really hammered it. The crowd went nuts. And he kind of laughed along with it. But, I don't know, a week later, I got a call from Mrs. Secretary. She says, Vince McMahon just called. He's looking for you. He wants you to call him back. So she gave me his number. I called him. And he said, I'm doing this new thing, kind of like going into unknown territory here, but I think it's exciting. I want to do an event every week live from a location in the city. And I would like to have you be part of it. I'd like to have you, you know, be part of the team. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure. You know, at the time, my oldest son was completely into, you know, into wrestling. Yeah. All three of them were at various parts of the life. Actually, he's back into it now that he's a, you know, a 33-year-old father. He's back into wrestling. Yeah. But, and I went up and I woodshedded a little bit with he and Randy in Stamford at the headquarters, watching old matches and whatnot. And it was pretty clear I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I mean, I really had no...
You weren't a wrestling fan.
No, I wasn't at the time, but I mean, I knew enough just to get me in trouble, you know? Mm-hmm. And right. So I started, and I mean, it was that first moment when they threw it, when you threw it inside to Vince and Randy, myself, that, and I've watched it, you know, a number of times since then. And it's just almost like the moment I come on screen in my head, I hear wah, 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 wah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was just, oh God, I was so awful. So awful. It's remarkable that I lasted as long as I did on that show, because I was really, God, I stuck the place up. And, you know, to his credit, he stuck with me, you know, and I really loved all the people I worked with. Macho Man, you know, Randy was just a great guy. Bobby Heenan was another great guy. Kevin Dunn, the producer, I just knew a lot of the guys who were such great guys. And I like doing it, but I really wasn't that good at it. Towards the end, I kind of got a couple of shots in, but...
Yeah. So what do you think it was, though? Because it was just so far out of your element?
I think that, you know, it's a fine line with professional wrestling, where it's the outrageous, exaggerated world taken completely seriously. And although it's outrageous... and over the top, to make fun of that almost doesn't kind of work. You know what I mean? It's already larger than life. To try and take it anywhere else really just doesn't work. You know, that coupled with the fact that I really didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah.
So I think that was, you know, one of the main reasons. Because you notice, I haven't really had anybody do it since. Yeah. I was like the grand experiment that went awry, you know?
Yeah, well, that is, you know, it really is a tough world, as you learn very quickly, and the audience is very particular, as they are, again, seeing with the product today. But right. It's true. And, you know, I came from another world, too. I came from, you know, I had worked at Major League Baseball productions before that. I had, you know, a sports background. But as far as wrestling went, I didn't know very much at all. And it was a crash course. I mean, fortunately, I wasn't put into a situation right away where I was doing commentary. You know, my stuff was pretty much, set and telling people where events were going to happen and holding a microphone until I got the swing of it. But it's a brutal world. You say there's a fine line and there's one side and then there's another. And either you're right. In or you're out. There's no, oh, yeah, kind of like him.
Right. Oh, yeah. I was very black and white. And it wasn't until, like, the last two episodes I was on that I think I kind of got a little bit of, you know, a couple steps up with the fans. They both happened at the hockey arena up in Poughkeepsie, where we used to go once a week because Manhattan Center wasn't available all 4 weeks of the month.
Yeah.
I forget the name of it, but... one night it was Vince was not doing the show because he and Randy were going to some award ceremony. They were getting an award for all that they'd done for charity and whatnot. And so they put me together with Bobby Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon. And I thought to myself, well, now Vince isn't here. And I kind of was doing an impression of him backstage to the amusement of the other wrestlers who were, you know, always looking over their shoulder to see if he was coming down the hallway.
Right.
So I had Sharon, I think her name was, the makeup lady, make me up to look like Vince. She gave me shoulder pads for the tuxedo jacket. She painted my lips larger so I got the full, you know, Vince McMahon lips and slicked my hair back. And I basically did the impression that I do of him the entire show, which is saying nothing, just kind of going, and Heenan, you know, it tickled Heenan, but Gorilla was like, what is wrong with this guy? And I did that the whole show. Well, the crew, the wrestlers, everybody went nuts. They couldn't believe I had, you know, the stones to actually make fun of the boss like that on national television. I guess nobody had done it prior.
And the crowd?
The crowd kind of took to it too, you know. Yeah. It's a couple of kids, you know, as we were walking to the back, that were, you know, looking for autographs and whatnot. I thought, okay, maybe I got something here. Yeah. So following week, we're back at the Manhattan Center, and, you know, we're all in the back, and Vince comes in, and he calls everybody in, crew, all the wrestlers, all the man, everybody in the little room where they used to do the catering, you know, the grilled chicken and the pasta and the steamed vegetables. And they're all crammed in this little room. And he looks at me and he goes, Bartlett, you're fired. And everybody went nuts. And, you know, he thought it was really, really funny. And I guess he thought it was funny. I don't know. He made it like he thought it was funny, but I'm not so sure he thought it was funny.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, the following week, there was an event at Madison Square Garden, and I took my son and a bunch of his friends to go see it. You know, and I'm thinking, well, you know, your dad's part of the announcing team on the top-rated show network, I'm sure we're going to be sitting ringside. So they were all excited. Went backstage. They got to hold the belt. They met all the guys. They met, you know, Virgil and Randy, Steiner Brothers, everybody. And we go to the show. I'll take you to your seats. All right, so take us to your seats. And we walk, and we walk, and we walk. And literally, the row below the ceiling is where all of us are sitting. And I'm mortified. I'm absolutely mortified. And so I go down to go backstage again. And Vince says, "What are you doing here?" I said, I'm, you know, I'm in the nosebleed section. I'm in New Jersey. I'm at a building." He said, "Well, that was a whole idea. It was going to be a joke. We're going to call out your name and hit you with a spotlight and watch you do the walk of shame all the way down to the ring."
Yeah.
I said, "Oh, okay. That's not going to happen." And so then they announced me. In the ring was Giant Gonzalez and his manager. I mean, Harvey something was his manager, I think. I can't remember.
Harvey Whippleman?
Yes. Harvey Whippleman, I think, was Giant Gonzalez's manager. And Giant, I guess, was like 7 and change, maybe 8 feet tall. And, you know, they kind of made him out to look like the Missing Link with the costume and the fur arms and all that.
Yeah.
And so we have this little exchange back and forth where, you know, Harvey is making fun of New York, and it's a city of losers, and it's dirty, and I'm standing up for New York. Now, I've gotten booed the entire time I walked into the ring up until the point when he started making fun of New York, and I stand up for New York.
Yeah.
And it's the greatest city in the world. Yeah. It's the center of the universe, and I'm thinking, now I'm really going to get the crowd behind me, and they're still booing me. They're still booing me. And so I kind of make a move like I'm going to throw a punch, and Giant Gonzalez puts his hand on my shoulder and gives me one of those Spock pinches and pushes me down on my knees in the middle of the ring. And then I did my my finish move, my, you know, my famous finishing move. I ran out of the ring as fast as I could. And following week, we're back up in Poughkeepsie. And, you know, Vince is kind of laughing to himself, and, you know, he's got me back. I'm thinking, fine. He says, "Well, you're gonna break up a fight between Luna Vachon and the Sensational Sherry. They're going to get into a fight in the outside of the ring, and you're going to break it up." And I said, "Okay." So, you know, we're doing the show, and I'm sitting ringside with the, you know, the Tammy from Time Life Books headset and microphone. And, of course, Luna Vachon comes out, and, you know, I was not familiar with Luna Vachon, and so I immediately thought, oh. And, you know, Sensational Sherry was there, and they start getting, you know, ugly with each other, and they start this really out-and-out, down-to-brass tacks, no-holds-barred catfight.
Yeah.
And they're just tearing each other apart. And Vince goes, go. I go like an idiot. You know, I go out and I try to separate the two of them. And I think it was Sherry grabbed my shirt collar, you know, right with a button where the first button is.
Yeah.
And pulled down and tore my entire shirt and T-shirt right off my body. And then I did my, you know, my patented finishing move. I ran into the back. So I'm in the back and I asked Sharon, the makeup lady, I said, "Make me look like I've really gotten the crap beat out of me." So she puts on blood and bruises and blackens one of my teeth. And I'm back there for a whole another segment. Well, they go to commercial after the segment I was in the back. And we come back on the air, and I come staggering out like I'm completely dazed.
Yeah.
And the crowd goes crazy. And, you know, I basically got back behind the table and continued to do the rest of the show. And that's when the crowd all of a sudden thought, "All right, we like this guy." And then I think that it was the next week I said, "You know what? I'm really not right for this. I don't think I'm ever going to get to a point where I'm going to be doing anything that's going to be helping this show. I certainly am not bringing much to it. I think I'm just going to take my leave." And Kevin Dunn said, "You know, I'm really disappointed. I had an idea we were going to do a show together for the network, because he and I were spitballing, and I thought it'd be really great if we did like a little Saturday Night Live show using the wrestlers as the primetime players, you know, and you know, just do sketches, you know, based on the wrestling world or not wrestling world. And I think I wrote a sketch for Yokozuna where it was a commercial for, I forget which car company, but they rolled the ball bearing across the hood of the car and all over the car. And so I think it was like the 1998 Yokozuna, whatever the date was, and we're going to drop a marble on Yokozuna and watch it as it kind of rolled around until it dropped, you know, down the back of his crack underneath the diaper, and then that made him, like, run. So that was the way he got it started. It never happened. But, yeah, you know, I look back fondly on those days, and I'm kind of sorry it didn't work out. But I'm very honored that I'm ranked in the top 10 worst wrestling announcers of all time. You know, I'm still not number one. I'm working as hard as I can to get to that point. But it was a crazy time, man. It was a really crazy time.
I mean, do you think, you said that, you know, you started to feel a little bit more and more. Do you ever think, you know, maybe if I would have just stuck it out, maybe I could have been a big part of this?
You know, I thought about it hard, and I thought, you know what, maybe I could, but it had taken like almost 13 weeks at that point. Uh-huh. And I just kind of made a little chip in the ceiling there. And I thought, you know what, I'm really not doing this show a service. I gotta get out. You know, just so the death threats would stop and, you know, stuff like that.
Your family would be safe again.
Yes.
you could get rid of the security team.
Right. I didn't have to, you know, pull the hood over my head when I left the house.
Yeah, right. What was Vince's reaction though to that when you went to him and said, look, I just think
he never contacted me. I think he was upset that I hadn't really spoken to him about it. Mm-hmm. You know, in retrospect, I probably should have, but, you know, I was kind of scared of him. So, but I got to say, you know, I think I've said this before in various interviews, Vince McMahon is the P.T. Barnum of our time. There is nobody who knows how to give a crowd what they want like he does. And, you know, he's got the empire to show for it.
Yeah. Now, you talk about people like Randy and Bobby that you, of all the guys, probably you got the opportunity to work with them the most. But who, what was your relationship like? Tell me first with Randy, because, you know, Randy could be tough. And especially with people from the outside of wrestling. But it sounds like, he was pretty cool with you.
He was really, really kind to me. He, like, went out of his way to try to make me feel welcome, make me feel comfortable, anything he could do to help. You know, he'd bail me out when I would, you know, kind of talk myself into a corner, and he would bail me out. I mean, he was a real gentleman and a really sweet man. And he was very, very kind to me, you know, and Bobby was the same way. Bobby was just a great guy. He loved what he did, and he shared that love with everybody he, you know, came in contact with, and, you know, had a blast with him.
Well, Bobby was like that too. And from your viewpoint as a comedian, when you looked at somebody like him, do you think he could have made it outside of wrestling as a comedian in that world?
No doubt in my mind. There's no doubt in my mind. He had a Rodney Dangerfield-esque quality to him, I thought.
Yeah.
You know? Quick, real, like Quicksilver, man. He was amazing. He could pull something, you know, out of the air. I mean, he really, you know, and I said to him, I said, you know, anytime you want to do an open mic night, let me know. I'll get you on. And I think you have the basis for a really good act. You know, and he was smart too. I mean, both Randy and he were very, very smart guys. You know, and that also helps. I mean, you can't be a comedian and be dumb. You know, except for me. But I mean, you got to know what you're doing. So I thought he would have been great.
You know, because they had primetime wrestling. We'd have this live show with an audience, and Bobby was always so awesome. I mean, he was great with, you know, that magic between him and Gorilla Monsoon. Was to me like any other great comedy team.
So great. I mean, they were like Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
No, he was great. I mean, it was very sad.
So what do you think, and I love picking your brain on this because you've been around comedy your whole life. What do you think it was that worked so well between the two of them?
I think they knew each other really well. You know, I mean, I got the feeling that they knew each other from the old days, and they had worked together a whole lot, and they came from the same place, and they were very attuned to each other. Like, they would finish each other's sentences kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like the right chemistry between the two of them. I think they both trusted each other. And that's key with any kind of comedy team. You got to trust each other. You know, it's the same way in acting, you know, whether it's stage or film or TV, you have to trust who you're working with. So that way you can do what you do and they do what they do. And that's the best you can get is when everyone does what they do. And, they had that trust, you know, and even when we weren't on the air, you know, just from the limited time I had with the two of them that one night, you know, you could tell there was a fondness they had for each other. And, you know, just even talking about regular stuff, you know, Bobby talking about his kids or whatever. It was, and then I remember the night Gorilla died.
Yeah.
They did the bell, the moment of silence with the bell, and I got really choked up. I mean, it was a very moving thing. I mean, he was so beloved, you know. So.
Yeah, and I wish more people knew him the way, you know, we had the opportunity to, because, you know, I've talked about it many times. I wouldn't have made it that first year if it wasn't for Gorilla. I mean, if he had not, put me under his wing and helped me along the way. But he was just such a great person, and a lot of people didn't really ever get to see that side of him because they saw him, you know, with Bobby and, of course, in front of the cameras. But he really was just an amazing guy.
He was a class act, you know. So was Bob. So was Randy.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, Nature Boy was a class act. He always called me sir, which I never really understood. But, I mean, just really classy people, you know, like real gentlemen.
You know, the world of professional wrestling, it is, as you saw, it is a very different world than a lot of people even know as far as the, you know, the kayfabe side of it. And you were there when that was still, somewhat part of the business. What do you recall of really seeing the difference of how that was? I liken it in some ways to the mafia. Now, of course, you don't get whacked, but there was a lot of that. That
we don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know if anybody doesn't get whacked. A couple of people went missing, I think. No, but it's definitely a brotherhood. There's a brotherhood there for sure.
Yeah,
you know.
And when was your? Do you remember like the first time that you really felt that boy, I am not part of this world yet, with the boys?
Second or third episode, I think, in the back, it was just kind of clear that I was, you know, to use the George Gobel reference, I was the pair of brown shoes on the tuxedo. You know, it was like it just doesn't. You know, one of these things is not like the other, and it's the fat guy in the sunglasses. That's. Who's not like the other. I mean, I think Yokozuna was the first match of the first show. Mm. And I think the first words out of my mouth were something like, wow, Vince's got an ass like an amphitheater. And I remember looking at Vince's face and all the color just drained from his face. It was like, oh, Lord, what have I done? You know, and I think I followed it up with that's one big Oriental, Vince, and he jumped in on top of it as quick as he could, and I think Randy even said, "I don't know about this kid Bartlett."
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to. Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo, and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yes. I forgot you do a good Randy, too.
Well, thank you.
The Macho Man.
I missed him.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that you did have that relationship with him because, like I said, Randy could be tough. It took most of the time with people. It took a long time to get to that point. I mean, it was way beyond a year before I got to that point with him. So it's, but I think that probably, you know, a lot of it might have had to do that he was kind of put in that position too, that, you know, to be an announcer. You know, not that he hadn't really done much before, but to be put in that position, you guys were kind of like, you know, this is us. We're on this little boat together with Vince.
I mean, there was only one time it got a little tense between Randy and I. I had actually taken my son to see the match where he proposed to Miss Elizabeth in the ring.
Uh-huh.
And it was like very early on when we were training up at Stanford at the complex. And I mentioned that I did an impression of him. He said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Miss Elizabeth, will you?" And he like looked at me like, if I said another word, I was going to lose my Adam's apple. He was going to reach into my throat and pull out my Adam's apple. And I guess, you know, they had kind of split up and it wasn't a really good breakup. Ooh, and he was very sensitive about that. So I never brought that up again.
Well, I'm glad you didn't stop doing the impression because it's a good one.
Well, yeah, I would do it, you know, sometimes looking over my shoulder to make sure he wasn't coming down the hallway. I don't want to take any chances.
Yeah. Well, it really sounds like, Rob, like you cherished that time, whatever it was, as brief as it may have been. But I'm sure it opened up a new world to you. And, it's great to hear that you do look back at that time fondly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how could you not? I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy world at a crazy time. And, you know, I actually caught it right between when it was really big with Cyndi Lauper and then when it got really, really big again, you know, the year after I joined. So it was I kind of got stuck in the valley between the times it was really immensely popular. And I don't think it's dipped since. You know, it just seems to me it just gets bigger and bigger and more popular.
Now, before I let you go, though, and we didn't even talk about the Hulkster, but I know you do a great Hulkster. And how much did you get a chance to work with him? I don't remember what was going on with him at the time, but what are your memories?
I think I met him. You know, he did one of the shows. He had a movie that had just come out. I don't know if it was Mr. Nanny or the one where he played the
The one he was nominated for an Oscar for, that one?
Yeah, that's the one where the screenplay won the Pulitzer, I think it was.
Mr. Nanny or No Holds Barred? Yes.
Yeah, one of them. It was one where he played a spaceman who came to Earth. I don't really remember what it was. Yeah. But he was on to promote that, obviously, and he had kind of segued into a movie career. So that's what it was about for him. And he was, again, just a real classy gentleman. Very, very nice, very friendly, very warm. And I started doing him on the Imus show years and years and years later. And he actually was a guest one morning. And I think it was maybe the day that all the stuff went down with his wife and the tape, the leaked tape. And the Chicago DJ, whatever his name was. And so he was at his worst. You know, he was at his lowest. Mm. And, he knew that I did an impression of him. And he didn't really have much to say about that. I mean, but it was really sad. He was crushed, you know, and I really felt bad for him. He just, all the life was out of his eyes. He just was at the lowest point. And I really felt for him. You know, I really felt for him. But, you know, it looks like he's pulled himself back up. He's a survivor. Yeah. That's somebody who gives up easy.
So he wasn't around when you were there? Was he off doing other projects?
No, I think he had gone off to do the movie thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, and the thing is, we kid about it, but, you know, Hulk, Terry really deserves a lot of credit for that crossover. I mean, at that time, he really was the first really big time. I mean, where he was mainstream. And where he was doing Hollywood movies, box office, and I don't know if he gets enough credit for that because now we see it. It's all you know to see somebody like Dwayne Johnson or or John Cena in these movies. Just, yeah, well, they're just doing something different in entertainment.
These guys wouldn't be where they are if it weren't for Terry. I mean, he really, you know, broke the, I guess, the wrestling glass ceiling into legitimate acting and, you know, opened the door for guys like them to really do well. I mean, I think, obviously, the two of them, Dwayne and John, are really, really talented actors. I mean, they're both really gifted comic actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, their timing, their sense of timing. I mean, John Cena in the movie with, female comic's name?
Amy Schumer?
Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
He was a screen
wrecker. Yeah.
Yes. He was a scream in that movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Dwayne is like, I've never seen him be bad. Yeah. You know, he's got confidence, he's got the timing, he's got the personality. They're both really likable. Yeah. I think that's also part of it, you know.
Yeah. How can people get in touch with you? I mean, do you have the email address or Twitter?
On Twitter it's at the Robbio, TheRobbio. On Instagram it's the Robbio, I mean, it's Robbio Radio Comedy, I think is the Instagram.
Yeah.
And and the email is Robbio Radio Comedy Hour @gmail is the email. So
awesome. Well, as you take us out of here, can you give us a little Hulkster?
All right, brother. I'm going to come down on you like nobody's ever come down on you before. I'm opening up a great big can of whoop ass on you, brother. See, I'm not even doing it justice. It's been a while since I've done them.
All you got to say. All right, brother.
Yeah, brother. Brother is really the whole thing.
Excuse
you know?
Brother. Yeah.
When he called me brother.
What you going to do? What you going to do?
Yeah. What you going to do, brother?
Hulkamania.
I'm a real American. Hulkamaniacs. Well, Hulkamaniacs out there. You know, want you to brush your teeth. He was great.
Take your vitamins. Rob, it's been awesome.
Thank you, Sean.
It's
thanks
been
so
awesome
much for
catching up. And I love to talk to people that love comedy as much as I do.
That's great. And, you know, we'll have to do that thing where you do the ride along where we watch a thing together.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm going to want to do that with me. We'll do the first episode of Raw. It'll be a blast.
Oh, that'll be a lot of fun. That'll be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're in.
I'm in.
All right. Awesome. All right, man. It's been fantastic. I love catching up to you. And it really, it's so awesome that you do remember that time. A great time. I thought I enjoyed it. I thought that, you know, it was to me, it was just it mixed it up. It was something different. And look what it's become after all these years.
Right.
And you were on the ground floor of that.
It was live. You know, it was a 1994, I guess. It was live.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I mean, it was unbelievable. Really unbelievable. He had vision. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Vince had a vision. Listen.
All right, my friend. Great talking to you. I let you get on your way, but thanks so much for being a guest on Primetime.
My pleasure, my friend. You take care of yourself. I'll see you soon.